everybody. This is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
Welcome to the Invested Podcast, where we are talking about Warren Buffett-style investing, even into the teeth of the storm known as GameStop.
Ooh, and I love
Reddit.
That. Yes.
And get rich quick. And Bitcoin going to 50,000 now,
yeah,
with Elon Musk putting $1.5 billion of Tesla money into Bitcoin. That was breathtaking. I have never seen anything like that before. That'd be the equivalent of putting $1.5 billion into gold. You know, I mean, it's just like, what? I mean, it's not an asset that you can judge. In fact, we should start with that. We're going to get to Li Lu here today, but let's start with Bitcoin real quick.
Go ahead. What do you want to say about Bitcoin?
Well, just that it's impossible. I was on Clubhouse yesterday, and this whole app that's been around for about a year now, where basically you can listen into a conversation with really brilliant people, and then it's not recorded. It's just there and gone. And I was listening to Brian, someone's last name I've forgotten, who is the founder, apparently, of Coinbase, or the CEO of Coinbase. I'm not sure. In any case, he did a history of the whole thing. And
the history
was asked
of Coinbase.
Of Bitcoin and that kind of stuff.
Oh, of like cryptos.
And somebody asked him a question, how would you put a value on this thing? What's the intrinsic value of Bitcoin? Hmm. And it was like, what started off like that. And then it went to, well, it's the price anyone would pay, just like stocks. That's the intrinsic value. Like, oh, really?
There's one you can sink your teeth into.
Right, because as you guys know from listening to hundreds of these podcasts, that we disagree rather strongly with that point of view. We think stocks are very special in that they produce cash flow. Businesses produce cash flow. And I should say businesses, not stocks.
Yeah.
And we own a small piece of businesses when we buy a stock. So businesses produce cash flow if they're a good business, and that's how they get valued. How would you know what to pay for a business? Well, what cash flow is it producing over the years, and what would you be willing to pay in order to get that cash flow? That's how you'd value the business. And something similar like that goes on with bonds, right? They produce cash flow, and you could choose what do I want to pay to get that cash flow? And there can be quite an argument about what to pay, certainly, but it's not whatever somebody wants to pay. That isn't really the end result of long-term investing. It is, on the other hand, what just happened with GameStop, and really bolsters this guy's argument a bit.
It's actually quite interesting because there is so much opinion out there right now that it is whatever anybody else would pay. And
yes,
there's actually a lot of evidence in real life that right now that is true. So really, in the short term, I would say that is actually a real thing, that it's whatever somebody will pay you for that stock, let's say, not related to the business, but really as a stock, right? Which is like very similar to cryptocurrencies. But in the long term, that is not how it works. In the long term, it has to be pegged to some real world, real life production.
That's what we agree with Ben Graham. You know, in the short run, the market's a weighing machine. In the short run, it's a voting machine. In the long run, it's a weighing machine, meaning just exactly what you said. It's that the emotions of the market, whoever's most afraid or whoever's most fearless or whatever, will set the range of prices in a market, including for Bitcoin or gold or stocks or whatever. But what makes stocks unique is in the long run, the market will price things according to a reasonable range of value for its long-term cash flow. And that is axiomatic to Warren Buffett investing and Charlie Munger. You might disagree with it, but you're taking on Buffett and Munger and Graham and Gates and 90 years of successful investing. You're challenging that and saying that, no, that's not the way it is.
What I think is so interesting about cryptocurrency is very similar to the whole GameStop insanity, but maybe exactly the same as the whole GameStop insanity. It feels very much like people wanting to be able to I don't know if this is quite right to say, but like control their own destiny, like have something that they are choosing to have power over that's separate from a government. Like most currencies until now have all been linked to a government, to a fiat, a military behind it. And these currencies aren't. And it feels a similar or maybe the same vibe of like, here's why we're so excited about it. It's separate from that. It's separate from the idiocy we see day in and day out with various governments. And we like it that way. You know, I feel like there's a vibe of that.
There is. And I think what Brian was saying is go buy some crypto, go buy some Bitcoin, and you will suddenly have a whole different feeling for what it is, in terms of its security, in terms of its anonymity from governments, and when you see the United States printing dollars like it's printing now, followed by Europe, followed by Switzerland, followed by Canada, followed by Australia, followed by everybody, in order to keep the parity between currencies. You're watching a massive and historic devaluation of the currencies around the world, and the Bitcoin theoretically can't be devalued. It's got an algorithm that says, nope, you can't get more out of it than there is, and there's a limit to it. And that's the trust that I don't have in the Bitcoin that these people do. Apparently, Musk knows more about the people who've created it and trusts them to not devalue his $1.5 billion. All they would have to do to cost Elon Musk and Tesla $750 million would be to split Bitcoin in half. And it could be done just blink of an eye, all right? I mean, I just
Is that actually that I, true? Do you know? I don't know if that's actually true.
I mean, I don't know how you'd do it, honestly. Maybe it can't be done.
I think it probably can't be done. I think that's part of the value
probably
of it.
Probably can't be done.
But
there's that outside of government control aspect to this that is extremely attractive when governments start doing the kind of thing
exactly
that they're doing now.
And the thing that to me is confusing and the, I don't know, the risk, I suppose, is that there's so many of them. I mean, you keep saying Bitcoin, but Bitcoin's just one. Bitcoin's right. Just a popular one.
Yeah.
There's so many different cryptocurrencies. So again, it's like, which one's going to win? And I don't know. But I do think cryptocurrency is not going away. Like, we're going to have some sort of cryptocurrency going into the future, I think.
There's a difference, though, between cryptocurrencies that are backed by nothing like Bitcoin and Ethereum and the new kinds of cryptocurrencies, which were also being talked about in this thing last night, that are being produced by governments, by central banks. So China is starting to experiment with one, apparently, and these guys fully expect the United States Federal Reserve will have created a U.S. dollar-based cryptocurrency.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense.
Which is just presumably convertible to dollars, right? I mean, that's how you do it now. I mean, you really can't buy very much with crypto, although Tesla's thinking of you can being able to buy a Tesla with crypto.
Yeah.
Which might make sense because you're buying a $100,000 car. You know, that's not your cost of the transaction will be, substantially diluted by the total value of the purchase price that you're making. You go out and try to buy a pizza with the cost of a Bitcoin transaction, you're going to get crushed. It'll cost you twice as much to do the transaction as it would to buy the pizza, at least as it was not long ago. So it's the cost, the actual enormous amount of friction in a Bitcoin exchange that keeps it from being a useful currency, but maybe that'll change over time. But I'm going to take us straight into...
That's what I was about to say. Interestingly, Li Lu, in his article, in his speech that we've been talking about, goes directly into different kinds of value and specifically talks about cash, treasury bonds, gold and silver, precious metals, and then stocks, and which one has done the best over time using some research from a professor from Wharton. And I mean, it is stocks won by a country mile, by 10 country miles, like crazy.
More than 10 country miles.
Yeah, more than 10 country miles.
It was really
amazing.
So just
let me say, for people who are just listening to this for the first time and want to go find out what we're talking about, this is a speech by Li Lu. You can find, he's an investor. You can find it on his fund website, which is HimalayaCapital.com. And then go to publications, and then it's called The Prospect of Value Investing in China. So if you want to go read it for yourself, that's where you can find it. It's available to anybody who has access to that website. And we talked about it a bunch already on a previous episode, and now we're coming back to the various, what did he call them? I want to say forms of currency,
assets.
But that's not right.
Assets.
Assets.
Yeah. So the to the point of Bitcoin, the dollar asset has dropped from being, he put these on a chart. He didn't do this. Jeremy Siegel from Wharton did this. Going back 200 years on these asset groups and looking at what they would buy today in the dollars of 1800, in the U.S. dollar of the year 1800, when the U.S. dollar, 20 U.S. dollars bought an ounce of gold, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that 20 U.S. dollars continued to buy that ounce of gold all the way till 1934, with a little variability right after the Federal Reserve Bank came in and started diluting the currency. But then the Depression snuffed out all that currency and brought it back to par with where it was in 1800. So the U.S. dollar for 134 years of our history bought the same amount of gold for that whole time. And then in 1934, as we discussed, FDR confiscated all the gold in America, and then turned around and offered to spend U.S. dollars to our European allies if they would send us their gold. He would send them U.S. dollars at double the rate that he had just paid for them for the gold in the United States. So he bought the gold at $20 an ounce, and then he sold it at $35 or $40 or something in that range. So it just... he didn't sell the gold. He sold the dollars at $35 an ounce. So effectively what he did is devalue the currency by nearly 50% overnight, effectively, in terms of what it would buy in gold. And then that devaluation continued almost without relief until this moment. And now, whereas you could buy a dollar's worth of $1,800 in 1984, you can now buy less than a nickel.
And so, Li Lu talks about it in terms of inflation,
right?
Not so much devaluation, which right. I really enjoyed, because that's exactly where we started this whole podcast and this whole investing journey of mine, really, was learning about inflation.
Oh, inflation can wipe out my cash under my bed.
Well, I didn't understand what inflation was, so...
And it's really hard right now. This is one of the most difficult things for me right now in investing, is knowing that last year they printed 35% of all the dollars ever put in circulation, and what that's got to do to the buying power, right?
But and, I mean, the point he makes is that what that does is that holding cash is probably the worst asset class you can be in.
Yeah, we think of it as the lowest risk thing you can hold. Right, which is where you started this whole podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to do the low risk thing here. And now they're wiping out the buying power of cash. Now we're heading more towards Zimbabwe than the old United States from 80 years ago. So we now, sitting in cash is painful. I mean, it wasn't so painful a few years ago, but now it's painful to sit in cash and wait for the market to move to a point where I really want to buy something. So you start to feel this pressure. You know, I like to keep a lot of cash on hand, and I know that Buffett's got to be feeling it, or unless, you know, he has nerves of steel because he's been here before. But he and Munger, I mean, Buffett right now has $160 billion in cash, and he hates cash.
It's just insane.
And it's like,
just an insane number.
Why isn't he buying something if he hates cash? And well, okay, he bought $14 billion worth of his own stock in order to put some to work, but the answer is basically that he said, you know, every so often, every 10 years or so, we end up with a huge economic storm and it rains gold. And when it does, you've got to be ready with a big bucket, not a thimble. And a bucket for Berkshire is dozens of billions of dollars, not, you know, a few hundred million. So for you and me, what that means is, If we were to act like Warren Buffett right now, we would load up on cash. We would have so much cash relative to any other asset that, you know, I would say probably we'd be 50% in cash relative to other assets that we own, other stocks that we own or so. And the only stocks I would own right now, if I was thinking like Buffett, would be companies that I think are still more or less on sale. I think, you know, they still got a long ways to go. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if I thought Ulta was, you know, a bargain at $150 and would be something I'd probably be thinking about selling at $300, I might be exiting Ulta at around 300, which is, you know, ballpark where it is.
Let's go through some of the asset classes that are talked about in this article, because it's pretty interesting. So he says, over the 200 years, and this is the professor who did the research, over the 200 years, cash has lost, and this is US dollars, has lost 95% of its value or purchasing power over 200 years. That's crazy. 95%.
Well, that's what we just said. Yeah. It'll buy a nickel.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. Buy a nickel, 95% computes more for me.
Okay.
Let's say it multiple ways.
Fair enough.
So if you could buy $100, you could buy it for now for $5. There you go. There's another form of
understanding. No, you just flipped it on its head, I think, there.
No. He's saying the purchasing power is 5 cents in the article. If you had one U.S. dollar in 1802, how much would it be worth today? It's worth 5 cents.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And then the gold, silver, precious metals, that purchasing power with $1 200 years ago is now worth $3.12. So a 3 to 4 fold appreciation in 200 years.
Again, this is post-inflation, right?
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
So post-inflation, the U.S. dollar has been wiped out. So you effectively apply inflation to it, and it's wiped out the U.S. dollar. Now you apply inflation to gold, and we know gold went from $20 an ounce to $2,000 an ounce, but it's only buying $3 where it used to buy a dollar.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, because of inflation.
Yeah.
Then bonds? Just the 10-year treasury bond.
Have achieved a return of 275 times their original value. Oh, sorry, that's treasury bills are 275 times their original value. Bonds are 1,600 times their original value.
So that's the difference between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates, right? So bills are short-term purchases of bonds, and bonds are longer, 10-year, 20, 30 years. So they're 1,600 times more than what a dollar bought in 1800, which is really good, right? After inflation.
Yeah.
After really inflation, that's pretty amazing. And that's about, 500 times more than gold? For those of you who are sitting here looking at Bitcoin, I think this is coming back to the point. In other words, if Bitcoin is the modern replacement of gold as a storehouse of value, except that the government can't get at it, and it's liquid, and you're anonymous, and it's the whole thing. If that's the case, then why would you expect Bitcoin to do anything different than gold did?
It's a fair point.
Right?
It's definitely a fair point. So here you go. I mean, the answer is that they see it doing something different than what gold is doing. But again, in the long run,
which
may not.
Which means... Are they getting, I'm not sure what that means other than people are just speculating like crazy in it and trying to guess what the value would be someday relative to gold, I guess. Or maybe it'll have some sort of value because of liquidity that's better than gold, I would think.
Right. It's just really high demand and low supply. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, probably. Which is very dangerous for, right? In other words, Picassos are very high demand, low supply.
Yeah.
Right? So maybe that's, well, maybe you would like to have your money in a Picasso.
Yeah, I think I would. Yeah.
But I think the price of Picassos has fluctuated really, really quite a lot. And by the way, I don't know if fine art has even kept up with bonds. I'm not positive after inflation. I think my guess would be that fine art would keep up with gold or other commodity type things. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know.
But here we go. Seem to have gone up
a lot. So, okay, stocks.
Yeah.
Stocks. If you had one US dollar in stocks in 1802, it would now be worth 1.3 million US dollars.
Nope. So, if you just had, I'm going to restate that. If you had just $1 in 1800, not in anything, it's just a dollar in 1800, and then you put it into stocks. Oh, maybe that's exactly what you meant.
I'm pretty sure. I mean, that's what I meant. Maybe that didn't come out right.
I think you did mean that. All right, good. So theoretically, it would have, if you just kept it there generationally, it would now be worth $1 million.
Or if you're a magical person who lived for 200 years and, you know, found the tree
of life.
Right,
if you're Yoda. If you're Yoda, you
dollar or if you're one of those time traveling people, I often think, what could I do if I could time travel backwards? Well, I wouldn't want to go too far backwards because I really like modern plumbing, but I could do a lot with my
knowledge. Modern dentistry.
Okay, that's a good one too. So his point here by Lee Liu's point by citing this research done by an academic is that stocks over a long period of time, very long, 200 years, more than our lifetime, has been by far, by huge amounts, the better returning investment.
Right.
So then he goes into why.
By the way, let me just put that clearly. That's ballpark 330,000 times better in real buying power than gold. All of you huge Bitcoin fans. 330,000 times more. And that's where I think you're going to run right up against a wall going 100 miles an hour with Bitcoin, is that once it's fully developed as a currency, it in my view, it has no more value to add. It's done. So you're speculating, right, on a scarce resource, hoping it'll go up. And once it's up, then it should appreciate roughly at what gold did, because it doesn't have any value add. It's not going to hang on your wall. It's just gold, you know? It's a store of value if the governments come and try to take you away, right? It's in a time of great crisis. Otherwise, what good is it? I mean,
it's interesting that you're comparing it to gold and not to currencies.
Because it isn't a currency. You can't pay your taxes in it anywhere.
But let's say you could, though.
Well, if you could,
can't pay your taxes in gold, by the way.
Right. Gold's not a currency either.
Yeah.
Gold is a storehouse of value and a hedge against.
So you consider a currency something that you can pay your taxes with.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the classic definition. If you can't pay your taxes anywhere with this thing, you know, it's seashells on the seashore, basically. You can try to pay your taxes in seashells, but they might not take it. Ultimately, that gives the government a lot of power over whether or not your Bitcoin or your gold is going to be of value to you. And I just reference you back to 1934. If you doubt that, the government can come in and take that thing, which you in 1934, many people were in fact thinking it was better than, it was a better currency than dollars, right? They were thinking of it in terms of that. And the government stepped in to correct that misapprehension.
Quickly. And I think to that point, what Li Lu then describes is his view on why stocks, companies have done so much better than these other assets, is because it's linked to the GDP of the country itself. And as inflation has gone up, so has GDP commensurately. And because of that, he sees that as the direct influence on the stock market of that country and therefore the underlying investment of the stock. And I think actually that goes pretty much to what you were just saying. Like having a nation behind these assets actually matters. And maybe a currency that doesn't have a nation behind it wouldn't have that same kind of long-term
really a good
asset
thought.
Valuation.
And you could almost argue that this is a chicken and egg problem or cart and the horse. It, you know, GDP is comprised of what these companies earn.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, or what they sell even. It's not even earnings. It's what do they sell? And that's a big chunk. Public companies are a big chunk of GDP, mm-hmm. as is the government, right? So those are the two big, huge components of GDP. And so you what Lilu is saying is that although bonds are very similar to GDP in the long run, in other words, they're tied very directly to GDP, stocks are better than GDP. In other words, stocks produce a higher return than GDP because historically there's a sort of a risk premium. There's a premium to own a cash producing asset. So you get a bump. If GDP is running at 4%, you're going to get 6 to 7% growth rate for stocks. And that little difference, not so little, over 200 years means that, you know, it'll outperform bonds by 700 times. Bonds and GDP will be outperformed by about 700 times, which is a lot. So, yeah, I think one more thing, though, before we wrap up here. And that is that what Li Lu was talking to these Chinese students about was what you should invest in China. And he was basically saying, hey, you could buy the market, right? But where's your value add? These are all students theoretically that are going to go be financial advisors and advise the growing Chinese middle class. He says, yeah, you could stick them into an index and here's how you'll do. But the problem with that is that indexes will go sideways in our history for as much as 26 years of sideways index. And as he noted, you know, Keynes, this economist from the 30s, basically said, yeah, the market can be irrational longer than you have money. It can continue to go down longer than you have money to short it, right? Or to go long in it. And that fact means that for most of us, it's not okay to think in 200-year chunks. In 200 years, it'll become super valuable. But in 200 years, we're dead. So what asset should we be using? What asset should we be buying if we have 20 years? What asset is that? And that's where he really launched into what we talk about all the time. So we're not going to have to spend a lot of time on it. But let me just summarize by saying, Li Lu's view is that if you want a reliable return over that is reliable over, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 year stretches, then you must buy a small number of wonderful businesses. That is your only true investment that can produce very, very high returns with very, very low risk relative to any other asset you could have. And that conclusion, of course, is how he invests. It's what he got from Warren Buffett, from Charlie Munger. It's what we teach you guys here. And it's really the bottom line of great investing is if you want reliable 20-year returns, there's nothing you can do better among those four asset groups than stocks. Now, you must be thinking like I am right now, well, what about real estate? Right?
Okay.
Right?
What about real estate?
I know. So it's very interesting that real estate's rate of return.
I was not thinking of that, actually.
I was thinking, well, what about real estate?
What about real estate?
I mean, real estate's overall return, unleveraged, right? Just apples to apples, because you could always put leverage into stocks too, but it adds to your risk. So real estate's unleveraged returns over the last 100 years have been roughly about 4%. So 4% before inflation, which means they come out really pretty close to gold, which is not a surprise. I mean, why would real estate go faster than that? What are you doing? Are you raising the rents at 10% a year? Is that how you're increasing the value of your real estate? And, you know, some people are going to point to, you know, specific markets where there's been an enormous speculation, like Jackson Hole, Wyoming, or right now, Bozeman, Montana on fire, right? Bend, Oregon, people away from the big cities. And you can point to specific time periods where that stuff really took off, and maybe it'll keep taking off for the next 100 years. I don't know, but in general, real estate, in general, has performed about like you would expect because it can only go up at the rate of inflation. That's how fast you can raise rents. In general, you can raise rents at the inflation rate. And you notice that by being a renter. You don't see landlords jacking your rent at 10% a year in very many markets. No. Not without a big legislation to put them on rent control. So, but you can do other things with real estate that make it attractive. You can become an active manager of your real estate, which is not what you're going to compare to with stocks. That'd be more like owning your own business.
Yeah, you buying something, fixing it up, that adding sure. value in that way, in the same way you would with a business, yeah. really.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So those two things I think are a little bit off topic in the sense that you're looking for, you know, passive investments. You don't want to be actually actively having to be in day-to-day management. And if we got into that, then yeah, you could argue that real estate could be really phenomenal if you're willing to get very active, and so could owning your own business. Absolutely. Go to work for Chick-fil-A and get a franchise. You're going to make some money, right? So, in general, I think Lilu is 1,000% right. And
it's really worth reading. It's really, really yeah, worth reading. Us talking about it does not represent the deep thoughts. No. That are in this speech. So it's really worth reading.
Yep. So go take a look at it, you guys. And we will be back with you in a week talking about how to do this better.
The never ending quest. All right. Thanks everybody. Bye.
Until then, time to go play. See ya. Hi guys. Thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information or to listen to additional episodes, visit our website at investedpodcast.com and sign up for my virtual workshop right there. Spots are definitely limited for this event. I'm not kidding. They really are. They sell out very quickly. So everything discussed on this podcast, by the way, is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion. And really important, it's not to be taken as investing advice because I am not your financial advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. So remember that. You're on your own here. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I really hope you enjoyed it.